Hi, well, thank you for four great papers. It's my pleasure now to introduce Judith DeGroat, who is our commentator today. She's Associate Professor of History and Director of Digital Humanities Initiative at St. Lawrence University. Currently, she's working on a biography of Pauline Roland, an article entitled History, Testimony, and Post-Memory, The Algerias of Pauline Roland and Asya Jabbar, has just appeared in the collection Memory as Colonial Capital, by Erica Johnson, edited by Erica Johnson and Eloise Brazo, by Palgrave Macmillan in 2017. Thank you, Judith.
Thank you, the four of you. Cultivating the World in the 18th Century. The connection to the Enlightenment that is evoked in the title of this panel in the four papers offers us delights from the gardens of intellectual curiosity. Sorry. But seriously, as Voltaire instructed, cultivating one's garden moves beyond the private pleasures to the broader productive realm of community. Today, these authors explore the relationships among and conflicts between scientists, colonists, ministers, and commercial interests, as well as offer insights into the contrast between plans and action. And importantly, they demonstrate yet again the enormous value of the explosion of memoir, scientific, political, personal, or a combination of all of them, for the historian seeking to understand the remarkable transformations taking place in the 18th century in all areas of society, in all areas of society, the economy, the world. Finally, and of equal importance, is the attention given to questions of environmental history, and I have the least to say about that. It's important for us to move on into discussion with these rich presentations. Oh, dear. Sorry. Is that better? Excuse me. So I'm going to confine my comments to just a few questions for each presenter and then a large one for the group, and let's get on with things. I'm going to start with Oliver, who argues that Andanson's proposal for transplanting acacia from West Africa across the Atlantic demonstrates an emerging link between commerce and commercialism in old regime France that parallels Bailey's imperial meridian for Britain. He contends that here's evidence of, quote, a natural affinity between gentlemanly capitalism and colonial civilization, end quote. And he also notes with apparent surprise that the noblesse des pays were interested in investing in this gentlemanly, i.e. bourgeois capitalism. It seems to me that such investment made good sense financially, as well as demonstrating the intertwined and contentious relationship built around colonial expansion. And here I'm thinking of the colonial governors of Senegambia, the Chevalier, who profited significantly from colonial exchange, and I'd love to hear more about his ideas on this subject. And I would also like to offer a suggestion for the project going forward. While the value of meta-historical work such as the Imperial Meridian is clear, I would urge him to avail himself of the current scholarship currently related to the questions he's exploring, as evidenced by the work of his co-panelists, among others. Now, Beth explores another proposal, this one for a garden of plants brought from around the world that would transform the region of Bayonne environmentally and economically. Michaud's speculative plan reveals, she argues, the role of complexity in the migration of plants, and I think we'd agree, but also of people and ideas. Michaud traveled and corresponded widely, and in the version I read, Beth notes his contacts with a range of ecosystems as well as trading networks. That was very interesting. And it would be interesting for her to develop that comparison and also to tell us a bit more about the question of what I'm going to call geolocation, for lack of a better word, that she poses. She discusses the directions of knowledge from both the metropole and periphery and raises questions about these peripheries, which ones they are, and also between the colonial and the global to and from France. And Julie guides us through the labyrinthine paths of the colonial machine as competing ministries, academies, and companies en route to providing coffee and filling coffers for all, in a case study of the commercialization of agriculture. I particularly enjoyed the story of Jussieu's commitment to botany for botany's sake, as well as to the idea of coffee as a health aid. I agree firmly. The primary focus here, however, is on the Compagnie des Indes and how it lost out as the capacity to spread biological diversity increased along with the encroachment of competing agricultural and commercial forces. The question I have is whether or not this study suggests that the machine may not be the best or the only metaphor for this process. Although it fits well with the mechanistic elements of the Enlightenment, the broken and malfunctioning cogs offer other possibilities that could be explored, and I wonder about her thoughts on those possibilities. Finally, April's Enlightened Planter offers us two memoirs written by actors, an engineer in Cayenne and a planter in Guadeloupe. She asks, how did Enlightenment arrive in the plantation, and presents a great historiography with packed footnotes. I really appreciated that. The manuals on estate management, which she reminds us are acts of self-presentation, as well as guides to future planters to cultivate, quote, the habit of enlightened reflection, assert that humanity and interests must be intertwined for the successful master, treating his slaves well enough to produce a happy, productive workforce. This Enlightenment approach looks to me, from my early 19th century perspective, very much like paternalism, and I'd be interested to hear how April understands the relationship between these two concepts. And this brings me, after far too long, I want to hear what you have to say, to the question I wanted to ask all of our speakers. Returning to Voltaire and the layered meanings of cultivation raised here, how did these planters, botanists, commercial agents and companies, even aristocratic patrons and sponsors, reflect, contribute to, and challenge that movement we historians call the Enlightenment? Thank you.
I'll go first.
Go ahead.
I'll start. Judith, thank you. That was a lovely comment. I'm totally with you about, as far as admiring and approving of Jussieu's commitment to botany for botany's sake and for the drinking and cultivating coffee for its health purposes, which is actually where most of my research has been up till now. I'm only recently moving into the commercial and the production side of it, so it's a whole new realm for me. And because it's a new realm, I've been really wrestling with trying to just understand at a basic level all these different competing parties, these ministries and institutions and the company. And the planter is sort of buried underneath it. I haven't even quite got to the planter here, so I'm really going to be depending a lot on April's insights for how to think about the planter within this whole system. I don't know if the colonial machine is the best metaphor. I'm finding it, though, extremely helpful right now as a way to grasp my sense that everything's interconnected. It's very clear that all these different interests are both competing, but they're also working together. So the botanists are traveling on the ships of the Compagnie des Indes, and the Compagnie des Indes is relying upon the Academy to approve or disapprove of different plants' properties. So, the fact that it didn't work very well, though, I don't know if that's just symptomatic of 18th century competing interests, personal interests, lack of communication, or if there's something deeper going on that I need to think about. So I will think about it. Thank you.
I'll take the question. And again, thank you very much for the comment. Yes, it is absolutely paternalistic. I mean, the material that you're reading in the British Caribbean, the material that Joyce Chaplin is talking about in the American South, there's definitely that movement towards this discourse of paternalism. It's absolutely spot on. In the book version of this, I do offer a counterexample to show that it's in terms of
sugar on plantations. And of course, now I'm not going to remember the name of either the priest or the person, but it is another planter. I believe he was on Dominica, who actually had published a very, very important treatise on sugar cultivation. He was a lot less interested in the whole aspect of managing slaves, but his model for managing slaves was completely based on kind of this concept of nobility. I'm on top, you're not. And, you know, you work for me. And it was completely functionalist and completely instrumental. I mean, you do not have this language of sentiment at all associated with his ideas about how you should manage an estate and how you should treat your slaves. And he published this, I believe this was in the 1780s, so it's completely contemporaneous with these two. So I don't want to suggest that this was a wave that swept through all this literature, that in fact there were different views about it, but that this was in fact there. So, yes, definitely. Thank you.
Thanks very much for the comments. Did investment not just make good sense? I'm not so sure. I mean, there's the kind of cultural taboo of the nobility getting involved in colonial commerce at all. It's seen as not, it's sort of beneath their station. So the idea that they would be, I think it would be to, on the one hand, to kind of assume a kind of rational, speculative mindset on the part of the nobility that I'm not sure that we can assume. And secondly to that, they also, these schemes didn't really succeed very well. These companies didn't tend to make a lot of profit. The company de la Guyane, I mean, each of these companies is the same succession of companies as a succession of bankruptcies. Guyana is like one failure after another. But failure seems to encourage more and more investment, of both capital and aspiration. So I feel like there's something more going on there than just trying to make a buck. So that's one thing. And the other thing is, I'm interested in both when and where the nobility starts to invest in colonialism. This is a moment where Choiseul is turning to kind of Enlightenment civil society to solve the problems of imperialism, to turn to explorers and to naturalists and to botanists. And to political economists to sort of say, what should we, you know, what can we do about this? How do we reshape our empire? And I'm interested in who really takes up that charge, as well as the kind of scientists and improvers. It seems like there's a lot of enthusiasm on the part of, you know, the noblesse de paix, the traditional nobility, to at least invest their capital in this. And so I'm interested in why they do it then, what happens in the Seven Years' War, or what kind of even sort of psychological effect, if you can even say that, happens that encourages the nobility to invest in colonialism at the time, and also where? I mean, why is it that Guyana is attractive in particular to these schemes? And I would just also qualify that by saying, yes, they're interested in Guyana, but they managed to also kind of have some kind of recover their losses somehow by keeping a toehold in a kind of relentlessly monopolistic market like gum, and also in the slave trade, which isn't an enormous market out of Senegambia, at least, but it does, in the 1780s at least, allow them to make some kind of profit. So.
Thank you very much. And I, in addressing your comment on my paper, I think I can also transition us into the larger question of the Enlightenment, in that André Michaud definitely saw himself as a man of the Enlightenment. He strongly believed that knowledge about plants, he does not seem, even though he's very much interested in finding some way to recoup the expenses that the French monarchical government and then Republican government never managed to do for him as he was touring North America and exploring it, he is a firm believer that acquisition of knowledge of ecosystems, he's not, of course, using that word, could be transformative. And you see the increasing sophistication of his thinking on it, not anywhere as sophisticated as where Alexander Humboldt will get a little later in thinking about the different temperate zones for growing things, but he's thinking in terms of latitude. He's planning where to go in North America based on what needs to be growing where in France, with the hope of addressing first and foremost forests for ship timbers. But he's clearly taking, in his journals and in his letters, taking careful note of what is growing where and the need to be ever more sensitive to the different climates. He establishes two gardens, as I mentioned, one in New Jersey and one in South Carolina, for the purposes of gathering the plants that grew in those different regions, different climate zones, and so forth, and understanding where they could be targeted to different parts of France. Application of knowledge for him, and a celebration of what it could do. Anyone else want to?
Well, if there's not the Enlightenment, I don't have a project. Put kind of crassly, okay? And basically what I'm trying to do in my book project, and I'm working both British and French sides of the Caribbean, is trying to determine what Enlightenment means in a Caribbean context, and how Caribbean planters, agriculturalists, soldiers, people who, newspaper editors, okay, I do a lot of work with newspapers actually, are making of Enlightenment, and how they use it in their own worlds, to make sense of their worlds, and to manage their worlds, and to manage their plantations. And in a way, part of what I'm trying to do here is that, when I first started this project, I would say a Caribbean Enlightenment, people go, wow, what's that? And now people are a little bit more comfortable with the concept, and I'm thinking of two really, really, really wonderful books that were published recently, Jennifer Palmer's Intimate, and Cul-de-Sac by Paul Cheney, and in fact Paul Cheney has a rather lengthy discussion of this idea of humanity and interest, where they both talk about Enlightenment, and Enlightenment in a Caribbean and in a planter setting. What I'm really trying to do is tell a fuller story about how Enlightenment gets there, and what people do with it, and how they respond, and how they, frankly, a lot through modes of sociability and various kinds of publications. So hopefully I'll make sense of that, I hope, or at least ask good questions.
Hi, I'm Gail Brunel. I'm always terrified of these things. I know it's not supposed to amplify me, but I'm so loud that, you know. My question / comment is for all of them, but really for Oliver, most of all. And I'll say, first of all, that I'm coming at this from the perspective that I deal with these issues in the 16th and 17th centuries. And what I would say is go backwards, okay? The tensions between the nobles and the merchants, and whether or not the colonies are going to be planter colonies or commercial colonies, and the involvement of the nobility in commerce, it seems to me, is very old. It's not new. It's not an 18th century thing. It's not something that suddenly appears with the Enlightenment. And similarly, the struggles between Paris and the provinces, where you have a Parisian nobility who want to control the financing and the companies of commerce, and a provincial merchants who have, I would argue, probably a much better understanding of the conditions on the ground, is again something that goes back quite a ways. So I'm curious, because all of the papers, but yours kind of struck me maybe because I've been working on Guyana now for a while, that there's sort of this sense of the Enlightenment in the 18th century almost isolated. So I'm curious as to how you see it in the relationship between these things that even in Guyana have been going on, even in Guyana for at least to the beginning of the 17th century.
Yeah, thanks. That's a great comment. I'm not saying that, maybe I should be a bit clearer. I don't think that this is the first time that nobles get invested in colonialism. What interests me is that the companies that they form, the Compagnie de la Guyane, is a joint stock company. So when I say gentlemanly capitalism, there is an emphasis really on capitalism, that these guys are speculating in quite modern forms of institutions. I think it's really interesting that this, and you were mentioning this also, this kind of, I wouldn't want to isolate the Enlightenment at all. If anything, I think what I'm really interested in is how those kind of old regime logics, those kind of deeper structures that you're talking about, are inscribed in some of these Enlightenment ideas of paternalism and improvement, and things that we think of as kind of forces of modernity that actually have very deep roots in a kind of patrimonial society like the old regime. So, I wouldn't want to say that this is kind of this moment of, emergence.
Dina Goodman, this is a great panel. I have a question for the first three papers. So I start with a story I found in the archives, which is a correspondence from a family. So here's the story. So this family invested in a coffee plantation in Grenada before the Seven Years' War. And they wasn't getting their first crop right around when the war broke out, and they were completely screwed. And when the war ended and they found themselves under British rule, they found this untenable. So what they did was they consolidated all their wealth there and sold it and moved to Saint-Domingue and bought a sugar plantation. So my question is, until we got to April, we didn't hear about sugar. And it's really refreshing, actually, to hear about other commodities but sugar. But it does make me wonder if what you think. Is it that is using the model of sugar distort our understanding of French, of colonization, plantations, botany, everything? Or do we need to take account of the oversized role of sugar? Does sugar really have an oversized role? And does that help account for some of the failures of these other schemes? Because when push comes to shove, people invest in sugar because it's a sure bet. Or am I just reading that in? So what do you think, how do you place these stories that you're telling and these other commodities, which you've all demonstrated are really important, trees, gum, coffee, in relation to the sugar economy, which we have all been taught was the dominant colonial economy, and the demand that everybody recognized, especially after the Seven Years' War.
Can I take a stab at that?
Sure.
Okay. One of the things I know it was directed towards them, but I can't help it. It isn't one of the biggest producers of cotton on the outbreak of the French Revolution was Saint-Domingue. It was a crop that was agitated for and that was naturalized and that was produced in Saint-Domingue in pretty large quantities. And if not for the Haitian Revolution, there's every reason to believe that this would have continued. Sugar is dominant, but coffee is incredibly important. And you have this pressure after the Seven Years' War, and the sources that I'm using, and these are sources created in Saint-Domingue by people who are living there, saying we have to create other forms of commerce. And these other forms of commerce, interestingly enough, are not just related to making money, which of course they are. Okay, they all want to make a lot of money, but also related to solving certain kinds of social problems. Like, what do you do with the refugees who have come to Kourou? Mm-hmm. How are you going to put them to work? And so and a lot of these things do fail, okay? A lot of these things do fail. I don't, like silk, I don't think ever makes it. There are people who want silk. Mm-hmm. But even though sugar is dominant, there is always this desire to move into other sectors. And I would even venture to say that but this is going to get me in trouble, I know it. The French Caribbean is perhaps not quite as dependent on sugar as is the British Caribbean.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I could see that.
Okay. So sugar is huge. We all know
that.
As far as solving social problems goes, coffee is also valuable, though, because it used land that the sugar and the mm-hmm. cotton growers found useless, which meant the land was more affordable, which meant that poorer whites, people of color, free blacks, could actually invest in and make a stab at. They didn't always succeed. A lot of time they went bankrupt. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they did something else. But coffee was it was maybe a bit of an outlet for people who might otherwise have been in real trouble because they couldn't afford to do sugar. So that's a value.
Yeah, I would just say also different modes of production as well, that sugar might have relied on a more intensive form of plantation slave labor than sugar.
Mm-hmm, it did.
It's kind of good
yes.
work on yeah. how that the kind of commodity that you're producing creates different kinds of slave regimes.
Yeah.
And I think the example of Michaud demonstrates that
it's not all about money all the time. It is in the wake of the French defeat in the Seven Years' War, we need a navy. How can we create a navy? Now, it's in many ways very naive, and none of the documents that I've looked at around the diplomatic and then botanical efforts to tap into North American tree sources, in none of the documents are they exploring the real chronological reality of actually building, you know, creating a forest, resuscitating French timber wealth as solving an immediate problem. But, you know, they don't wrestle with the fact that we're talking about decades, decades of work here. But it is about geopolitical power and not just the economy. The economy is part of that. And there's very great tension, in part because a lot of Michaud is directly in contact with other botanists. There is tension between the utilitarian and the scientific knowledge that he's gleaning, and they're constantly pushing him, especially as after the revolution, and he's working for the Republic. There is judgment made on the fact that your efforts need to be addressing the utilitarian, but the timber for the ships was utilitarian, and so it adds a dimension of interest, it adds a dimension of the belief in the importance of gathering colonial knowledge, not just exclusively for commercial application.
This was a great panel, and I really learning about a lot of things that I hadn't really thought about. But what it seems to me that unites all four of these papers is in some sense that you're all thinking about the supply side. And I think that and I'm not trying to say that you shouldn't, but I think that one of the ways to understand the trajectory of the projects that you're all talking about is in the nature of the demand. One of the reasons why they keep investing in gum is because it is literally they cannot do without it, and that there are very limited sources for it. The profitability of coffee, as Julie has pointed out, is complementary in land use, in use of resources, and you know the approach to sugar, as well as why don't many of these trees and things from other parts of the world work, there isn't much demand for them. And so I think that the focus on supply is wonderful, and I'm glad to hear it. But I think that in trying to understand the trajectory, I think you got to take it back through demand.
I've been doing demand up until now, so supply side is new for me. And I was in one of the things that I said at the outset here was that it was the demand that inspired so many different people around the world to say maybe we should provide some supply, you know? Yeah, and it's why they kept trying. They knew they could sell it if they could just figure out how to grow it, get their hands on some beans.
I think we'll try and do two more questions. We have one over here and one over here, so.
Thanks for a really great panel. I have a quick reference for Julia and then a question for Oliver. Julia, you may already know about this, but in terms of thinking about sort of the utility of the concept of the colonial machine, there's this great co-authored article by Paul Cheney and Loic Chaal called The Colonial Machine Dismantled, which really delves into, you know, thinking about what's useful about that term, what's problematic about term, in terms of sort of the mechanics of, Paul Cheney and Loic Chaal, the mechanics of thinking about what the colonial empire looked like in the 18th century.
Thank you.
For Oliver, my question, so first of all, I'll start off with the fact that I'm really sympathetic to the fact that you're using the term gentlemanly capitalism to describe this phenomenon, because I think there is sort of a tendency to view British and French economic life in the early modern period as totally different, and the fact that you're saying that gentlemanly capitalism is something that we can use to think about how the nobility and like high finance is involved in colonial trade, I think that's really useful. But I will once again second both the commentator and the earlier question about thinking about the exact, you know, chronology of this lineage, even with the joint stock companies, as you pointed out, because going back to the iterations of, you know, the Compagnie des Indes under Colbert and John Law, again, we see the fact that there is this tendency of the nobility and of high finance to really dominate the investment directives, to dominate the administrations of the company, and that's something that early critics like, you know, the Abbé de Saint-Pierre really point out and isolate as one of the flaws of the company's governance. You know, Louis Delminy referred to the Compagnie des Indes as a Versailles de commerce, and there's a reason for that, that it's very much dominated by the high nobility. And one thing that you raised about the idea of, you know, profit and loss and the fact that a lot of these investments fail, I would just encourage you to sort of think about how investment operated as not necessarily a thing where profit mattered, but was more about just a kind of social capital or social credit that that the nobility would be involved in regardless of the actual, you know, profit and loss dynamic. And in terms of that, I just wonder how much is 1763 really, you know, a demarcation line between two different kinds of gentlemanly capitalism? Okay.
Do you want to answer now?
Just a very short response, maybe?
The social capital point is great and well taken, and something I have to think about. The bigger question about whether it's a demarcation, I agree, obviously court capitalism is a thing in old regime France. Access to power helps with finance. I think what I'm trying to sort of gesture towards and try and put the pieces together is that there's a kind of matrix going on here, that it's both, the point of the imperial meridian framework is that it's both gentlemanly capitalism, but also what's going on in the colonial periphery is this kind of insistence on agrarian virtue and hierarchy. And so it's to try and trace the link between that kind of gentlemanly capitalism through these specific companies and what's going on in the companies that they're governing and financing. So while there might already be, you know, it's not like the after the Seven Years' War, the nobility suddenly thought, oh, hang on, we have a lot of money. Like, we can do something with this. I think that there's something particular about the relationship between that kind of gentlemanly capitalism and what's going on in imperialism at the time. And I take that to be Bailey's big contribution to the kind of Cain and Hopkins argument, is to try and see this in a kind of global perspective. So it's kind of what I'm trying to do. But yes, it's a good point that this isn't a new thing under the sun.
Well, obviously, the fact that so many questions have been raised and that we are asking you to do so many other things shows how seminal and how good the panel was. So I'll jump in and just ask on the line that Gail Brunel did. I am hoping that you will keep in mind what was going on in earlier centuries from the point of view of non-European exporters with whom the Europeans had to compete. And especially I'm thinking about coffee, which must have originated in Arabia, but not just in Yemen.
Just in Yemen. As a wild plant, it originated in Ethiopia. It migrated to Yemen sometime in the Kunas, God knows when. And it was the Yemenis who commercialized it. And all coffee came from there. It was traded by the Arabs. It was traded by the Ottomans. It was traded by the Indians, Gujaratis.
Fascinating to know, and I'm glad that you know it, because obviously in a panel you can't say everything, but if you have it in the back of your mind, you'll put into good perspective, which you have, what was happening in 17th, 18th century France.
Definitely.
Thank you for the panel.
Thank you, Dara.
Great, we're done.
Thank you.